This is The Biz of Wealth. Challenges, rumblings, and evolution of the wealth management industry.
Welcome to The Biz of Wealth. It's not often you get the honor to sit down with such a senior person in your own industry with similar background. Renee Brown, she was a journalist in her early years and became an extremely successful marketer for the financial services industry. She has executed and created market growth initiatives in B2B and B2C segments. She has led 21 brand integrations and launch of Wachovia, Wells Fargo Advisors, Abbott Downing, and Optum Care brands, in every case, achieving target goals and aggressive growth. She has also focused on emotional intelligence to build multiple high-performing marketing teams and contribute to talent development for team members. In this interview, we cover everything from her success stories to the main challenges that financial institutions face today. Please enjoy my talk with Renee Brown.
Well, Renee, welcome to The Biz of Wealth. Thank you so much for being here. It's an honor.
It's great to be here. It's a great way to start my day. Thank you.
So I see that you've been on a lot of media interviews. So what I want to ask you is, what do you wish you were asked more?
You know, a lot of interviews cover similar ground. And I think one of the questions I've always found to be insightful when I've listened to others answer it is, what has been your biggest life lesson? And I think that that question really applies to people in their 30s, 40s, 50s. I think as we continue to get more experience, I won't say get older, just gain more experience, you face more interesting situations. And I think with that comes wisdom. And so for me, when I've been asked that question, one of the things that comes to mind is, as I was younger, and I think this tracks with other people in their lifetime, when you're younger, you feel like you really have a handle on all the facts and the knowledge and really are the smartest person in the room. I think we've all experienced that. And as we get older and face new experiences, we become clearer and clearer that that's not true. And my biggest life lesson, I, at a younger age, thought everything had a right and wrong answer, and that there was clarity and something is either one way or another. And the gray area wasn't something I really believed was true. I thought that was people trying to play both sides of something and that you should either be in one side or one camp or another. And as I've gotten older, my biggest lesson over and over again is to really respect the gray area, that in every situation there is a middle ground, and there are situations that are both right and wrong at the same time. And that really came to light for me probably 8 years ago when I was deeply involved in social media for one of the organizations that I worked for, you know, leading a social media team, leading very young employees who are passionate in the space. I saw more situations that I could argue both sides that were both very right and very wrong, depending on what vantage point you were looking at something. And so I'm not saying everything is relative, and I'm not saying everything is squishy, but in a lot of things in our work world, it's not black and white. And I think folks who get older understand that and wrestle with that more than folks who are younger. So that embracing the gray area is one of the continuous life lessons that I have, because for me, as a more analytic person, I prefer things that are yes, no, right, wrong, left, right. But you learn more when you're in that squishy gray area.
So that actually goes completely against what I perceived what is going on in the world, actually. And now that you mentioned social media, that I consider one of the main contributors to the extreme positions we see in every aspect of, you know, society right now. How do you
agree?
Yeah, how do you find it compatible? Like, I actually see that older people are becoming more extreme too because of their influence social media has in them and the media and the way they consume the media and don't question it because they are used to not questioning the media. We both have come from a little journalistic background and we can talk to that.
Yes, you know, it's interesting what we see happening. And I have a lot of friends in different parts of the country that I do interact with on social media that I do not agree with, but I will not unfollow them, unfriend them, because some of those folks, while we disagree in a lot of areas, they are the most lovely people in my life. And if something were to happen, they would be the first people to show up to help. And that's what we all have to remember. Before we started talking about political things and disagreeing so adamantly, we had people who we disagreed with in a lot of areas. And you just don't talk about those things you disagree on because there's 80% of life that you have agreement and you really care and love for these, love these people. So it doesn't make sense to me how divided we are. I mean, at holidays, I have friends who've been, haven't talked to their family in 4 years. Because of political divisions. And that's just the saddest thing, because right now, when I look at my life, I don't have parents anymore. I've lost both of my parents. The thought of being able to have a Thanksgiving dinner with my parents, it would be wonderful. And there are some people whose parents are alive and they are not talking to them because of silliness. And it's so sad to me. It's like, I would give anything to go back and do that. Even, and I would think my parents would probably be in the category that I wouldn't agree with them on something. Right? I mean, it's just how things go. So why we think everyone has to fully agree with you on everything, it just can't happen. Even in marriages, right? Marriages, you don't agree on everything. And if you did, that would be kind of weird.
Yeah, I know. But now that you bring up your parents, that's a question I often ask. Like, how would your parents, you think, how would they describe what you do for a living? Because that gives me a very simple, sometimes simpler version of your career path.
It was interesting. My parents, my father worked for IBM for 33 years. He was a Vietnam veteran. And when he came out of the military, they had a program at IBM and they picked up a lot of the Air Force and other military folks to work there. And from that point forward, he stayed with IBM his whole life. And my mom was a school teacher and they're and a social worker. And so their lives were very much into you create something. And it was more of a tangible component. And so being in marketing and working for large companies, I don't think they ever fully understood what I did necessarily. They did understand if you know, a TV ad would come out and they knew I helped with that. But there's so much more to marketing that people don't see. And a lot of my job was mediation in larger companies. Marketing is usually right in the middle of the product and the business and sales. And whether people agree or not, marketing has to figure out how to thread the needle and make something work for the consumer and help the consumer at the end of the day. So I've always seen myself as a mediator. So when asked, I would give examples of, you know, my everyday was a lot about talking to three people who disagree about something and finding a common ground and figuring out how to keep the business, keep the business moving. I think my parents understood that at a rudimentary level. And also, you know, the financial world, my parents were not sophisticated financially at all. And so being in finance and actually supporting financial advisors, I know you're very active in that space. It helped me educate my parents as they got older around the stock market and that sort of thing, because they, you know, didn't have that background. They didn't have wealth per se at all. And so anyway, so to answer your question, I don't think they ever fully understood the role of marketing, because a lot of people don't, beyond the promotional side of marketing.
I still face that. Like, I actually have a friend that jokingly always calls me Chandler. Like, I don't get what you do. Come on.
That's a compliment. Chandler is one of my favorite characters on that show.
I know, I love him. But talking about that, what was, you know, you've done a lot of very large and complex projects. Which one was your most challenging or and or rewarding in that sense?
You know, I would name two. One of the most rewarding, I'll give the rewarding then the challenging. One of the most rewarding ones was when Wachovia and A.G. Edwards integrated and merged. That was one of the most fascinating projects of my career because of the people involved. So you had an organization that was mainly a bank and a decently okay brokerage company by a very well-known brokerage company. It was the biggest brokerage merger in history. And, you know, we would be in St. Louis on a weekly basis talking to these wonderful people. And just the work that we did there to take the best of both of those organizations and create what is now Wells Fargo Advisors, for folks who might not be aware, they have about 16,000 FAs. It was a wonderful project. Now, I will tell you, it was challenging because we rebranded that company to Wachovia Securities, and then the bottom fell out and we were bought by Wells Fargo. So within a year and a half, we rebranded the brokerage firm twice.
Oh, God.
Yes. And that was a lot of expensive signs, but it was and very logistically challenging. But it was a wonderful process. The other one I would name is in 2012, I was asked to lead social media at Wells Fargo. And it was one of the first divisions of the company that was centralized because, as you're well aware, social media isn't something you can have 10 different divisions doing different things for one company because the consumer would be completely confused, as would businesses. And that's what was happening. And so that one was very challenging in that we had to create a system that would work for a very large company and meet the needs of the B2B segment as well as all the consumer segments. And it was so fast paced, and we had to teach leadership the importance of social media. And that was really fun. And the way that we did that, I think you might think is funny. We created two command centers on both coasts. So it included screens that kept up with our sentiment, competitor, what was trending, all those kinds of things. But we created a kiosk, which looked like the size of an ATM with a bunch of screens. And we put that by the bathrooms on the executive floor intentionally, because on the 12th floor at Wells Fargo on Montgomery Street in San Francisco, all of those leaders would have to go to the bathroom at least a few times a day. So they had to walk by the social media screens and they would see if, you know, things were red or trending, and we would inevitably get calls because they didn't follow Twitter. They were not on Instagram or Facebook at the time because it was kind of new. Yeah. And so we get calls saying, what's happening with JP Morgan today? Or why are we trending about whatever in Atlanta? And so that was a very out of the box way for us to get the attention of our leadership. And it worked very, very well. And so anyway, that was a very fun 3 years. I actually wasn't really doing marketing as much as I was dealing with HR, with policy, with PR. And there was some marketing, but it really was just a great life lesson. And while it was challenging, I think I grew more those 3 years than any other time in my career because I had to learn. You know, new channels were popping up on a weekly basis. You know, you had different channels coming and going, and we had to figure out as an organization, do we have a presence on Pinterest or Snapchat? And what does that mean? And, you know, and then those kinds of things ebb and flow and evolve. So anyway, I can go on and on, but those are two that come to mind.
I love the story about the screen in the bathroom, because that's actually how my mind works a lot with customer journeys. Yeah. And how I try to, in my mind, imagine my client or whoever I'm targeting, you know, where are they? Where are they going? What are they doing throughout the day? What, you know, what is it that calls their attention? So that's super smart. I love it.
Unorthodox, but it worked.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, and we were talking about that, you do have a journalistic background. And how do you think that has shaped, you know, the way you approach marketing, or actually the way you approach business? Because you are very much in the C-suite anyways.
Yeah, you know, so when I was 16, I started as a radio announcer following my sister. And in college and graduate school, I was known as a traffic reporter, mainly in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And that shaped me in a couple of ways. The first way is being a traffic reporter in a very city known for really awful traffic. You have to consolidate all kinds of information into 30 seconds. And to do that over and over and over again for years gives you a skill that so many people in corporate America don't have. In fact, I have a lot of impatience for people that can't summarize things, but I go to the extreme.
Oh, I have the same thing. I can't read long emails. Just summarize.
Give me the three bullet points here. Don't give me a dissertation. Exactly. And so I realized early in my career, that was a real advantage that I could take a bunch of information and summarize it in 30 seconds. And people generally appreciate that. And it's also very important for marketers to be able to do that. But more importantly, I realized, particularly at a younger age, when they would ask me to work on creating commercials for some of the businesses that bought media, learning very quickly at a young age, it's not about you or your company. It's about the consumer and what's in it for the consumer. And always staying focused on others is the essence of marketing, and it's the essence of smart business. And so, you know, I was a kid, and they would hand me, here's, a Weight Watchers organization wanting you to do an ad. Go do it, And of course, I was being paid $5.25 an hour. So I was cheap labor, but hey, I was learning. So it was a great way to learn quickly.
How do you teach that? You know, I faced that challenge that a lot of companies, sometimes entrepreneurs, sometimes bigger, they speak about themselves first. And I understand that because, you've been building this business. You've been focused, on really like trying to get to a good, service proposition, product, whatever that you're developing. And you want to go out to the world and tell them what you've been doing.
Yes.
But they find it very hard to connect to, you have to tell them what you're solving for them. Do you exactly. have any advice on how to do that switch? Because it's pretty hard.
It is. And particularly with smaller businesses and folks who have founded a business, there's so much pride in what they've done that it's hard for them to put that in the backseat in lieu of really talking about the consumer or the business that they're helping. But you've got to. And there was a great example just this week. I mentioned I was traveling for business. We were meeting with one of a company that we work with. And this fella gave an example of an error their company made where they were actually doing a direct mail piece for an organization and they forgot a whole paragraph in the direct mail. And it tested better than any of their direct mail ever. And guess what the paragraph was that they forgot in the direct
mail? About their company, right.
It was the paragraph about how great their company was. And so now that company has direct mail without that paragraph, and it is the control because it performs best. So an error led to a business learning that, talking about yourself is not what the consumer is most interested in. Now, you need to have a website with about so that they can make sure you're not a fraud or a scheme or whatever, but that doesn't need to be part of what you do. But I think examples like that really help when you're working with folks and turning things around and saying, that's why B2C marketing is easier. It's easy to say, well, what works for you? When you hear something, what makes you respond? It's usually not about a business, with the exception of some businesses that are very purpose-driven and they're helping consumers. Let's say they're working on the environment, giving back, or they give to charity. Then yes, that could actually make somebody pick them over another company. Because they have a philanthropic.
That all started a few years ago. But you were saying the way to invert that that conversation is through examples, and that's great. And that it's easier to use it in B2C. I was talking to somebody the other day about the B2B proposition, and I was making my point that there is still, I was telling them, look, you have to start with an emotional message always. Yes. You have to claim to the emotional a reason why somebody would engage with you. And they would argue, but in B2B, that doesn't apply. And I was like, no, in B2B, there's still a person behind that business that needs to be engaged emotionally. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, and I would tell you that person has probably done reading. And if you look up the difference between B2C and B2B marketing, you will see people summarize, and it goes back to my first point about gray area. They'll say B2C is emotional, B2B is rational. You know, B2C needs to be short form, B2B can be long form. Well, those are the extremes. But I would agree with you that there are people behind decisions. There are people in procurement. There are people in different divisions of a company who are making decisions. And we all, as humans, don't want to be told that we make decisions emotionally, but we all make decisions emotionally.
Yeah.
Something about an organization or a product touches you emotionally, and it drives you to make that decision over another. It's like when companies pitch you and you sit there and listen to five companies, I generally land on the company who has the smartest people.
Right.
Because that's I want super smart nerds to work with, because we're going to hit things that haven't been dealt with before. And I'd rather work with really smart people that can maybe figure out a new way to do something. So that's I always lean on go for the nerds.
Yeah. It's not the flashy one. I remember this viral video of those like advertising agencies presentation that come like with, you know, they come with all the bells and whistles and they make these crazy things and you're like, what? Not anymore. So now that you are in the, you know, you made the jump, you come from corporate America, very much experienced in that. And you mentioned the other day, you know, you came, now you're sort of in the startup scene, technology scene. Is there something you miss from the corporate world now?
The corporate world, I love people. I think we have that in common. So I love meeting people and understanding people. And so with corporate world, I remember the last role I jumped into, I spent the first month and a half completely just meeting the people, because there were hundreds and hundreds of people. I needed to know, understand what motivated them and how we can meet their needs. Here, it took me one day to meet the people because the team is so small. So in that way, I miss having more people to work with, but I love the people I am working with. The colleagues that I've gotten to know and the scale is something that was a super fun challenge because of that people component. But the only other thing I would miss, and it's a double-edged sword, it's both a positive and a negative, and it's the resources. So larger companies, just as an example, marketing is, we make or break any marketing through the data that we have. And when you're with a large company, both of the bigger companies I worked for in my years, they had all the data in the world and data scientists and all these resources to tap into. And so where I am now, we're working to figure out how to, get to those resources through various vendors, but it's just not as easy. Things are not at your fingertips. But at the same time, with a smaller company, I can move faster. So I can make decisions much more quickly, which is something at larger companies, you know, if you want to bring on a vendor at a larger company, it could take 6 months or longer with 15 people reviewing things and, you know, the patience required to do something like that. And it also extends your projects and your deliverables. All of that I do not miss, but all the resources bigger companies have, you know, you could really tap into some amazing resources that, you know, startups definitely don't have access to.
Let me ask you something I'm curious about. You mentioned, you know, leading a ton of people. Mm-hmm. What tricks do you have to get to know them and remember them and engage with them personally when you have so many people to lead?
I actually learned a lot from the advisors that I supported all those years. One of the things about supporting a brokerage firm for years, I learned tips of the trade. And so back when we had corporate jets, remember that? I remember flying in the corporate jet with the brokerage leadership team, and I forget even where we were going, but they were reading their binders that were handed to them before an event. They would have events where the top financial advisors and their families would be recognized. And a binder would be put together of each person, their wife, their children, their interests, to remind the leadership of who these people are. And so when they saw them, they would know their both the spouse's names and the kids' names and remember. It's a process of remembering. It's not that you've forgotten someone, but if you don't have active work to remember that, you could accidentally confuse two people or whatever, and that's awkward. So I don't do binders of people, but I did learn a lot from that. That before, so one of the larger groups I led had over 200 marketers across the country, and we would get together. And before those meetings, I would go through the lists of people. I asked each leader to provide org charts with photos so that I could, because I'm great remembering faces, but I will confuse names, particularly if I think somebody's name doesn't match them. And that's a really judgy thing. Like sometimes I meet somebody and I'm like, that does not look like a George. It just, this person is more like a Jim. So I would spend time making sure to remind myself about who these folks are. And I also did, I had a mentor that when I started leading larger teams, managing managers of people, she sat me down and told me like her method, and she would meet with every employee in her whole organization, which was like 500 people. And that was just scheduled throughout the year, just 30-minute meetings, meet and greet, how's it going? And she said, those kinds of meetings, first of all, it's unusual that leaders do that nowadays. So the employees appreciate it. But secondly, you actually learn about what's working and what's not working in an organization. Not that people would tell on folks about something not working, but they would talk about resources they needed or a problem that they had, that a leader, if you're not doing that, you have no idea, because sometimes managers just gloss over issues and it's not, you know, they don't think it's important, but when it gets escalated to a senior leader with resources, things can be fixed and it can improve, you know, the employee morale and engagement level. So, managing large teams, it's how much effort you put into learning the people. And if you can learn one thing about them that you really resonate with or you have in common, it's so much easier to remember the person.
Right. Yeah. The human behind the position. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because everyone has, you know, if you have pets or kids, right, or where you went to school or what your interests are, there's got to be something that's memorable about everybody.
Yeah. So in the finance, how do you see the financial industry? Let's talk about that. You know, where do you see the finance industry going and where do you see it failing?
So I think in some of the parts of financial services that I've worked with through the years, it's very people dependent. And there's an assumption that the way that let's say financial planning has been done is not going to change, that you need a financial advisor and it, you know, there needs to be less transparency about these complex products. The generations coming up behind us want ultimate transparency. They want to be more active and involved. They even want to be in the driver's seat. And so I think the financial services industry is still making assumptions that the way our grandparents did their financing won't change. And I think it will change. And I think some of the algorithms that are given to large companies in their investment portfolios are going to be democratized and given to consumers. We as consumers are going to have access to capabilities that were only allowed for very wealthy people. And so I think that democratization is going to continue. I think the face of financial advisors are going to change as well. And transparency just has to increase. I'm lucky with the advisors I use. They're very transparent about their fees and what they're doing, and they add a ton of value. And I think they're worth every penny that I pay. But not all advisors are like that.
Right.
And I think there's going to be just a lot of pruning of the herd in that space in particular. But, you know, consumers are in charge. And I think financial services still are in charge of some things. And I think that's going to continue to change, where the power is going to continue to go to people, not to companies. That's my opinion.
Is there any company that you see that you like and or you admire in the space? Financial advisory, for example?
I think there are pockets in every organization that are doing a great job. So if you look at any of the big companies, they have groups of advisors, for example, that are focused in areas like in, you know, the environmentally friendly investing, as an example, or they have teams that focus just on areas like divorce, where a lot of consumers have tons of trouble with their financial lives. And there are people who dedicate themselves to helping in that way. And I think in those pockets, that's where there's a lot of energy. But also, if you look at how the companies are using their revenues, which are huge, you know, large financial organizations are slaves to the money they're making for shareholders. And there are some that are taking time to give back to causes that are bigger than just making money for shareholders. For example, Bank of the West, if you haven't looked at their website, they do amazing work with environmentalism. They give back 1% of their revenue to help the environment, and they have just wonderful resources on their website. So that's one I would call out that has moved to a different level of, we're not only getting rich here, we're going to help something, a cause bigger than us. And I think as more and more companies figure out how to do that, I think we'll be, financial service industry won't be viewed as the place where you can't trust that they are only looking out for themselves.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned algorithms, and I've seen already a ton of fintechs and even financial services companies, at least startups, trying to replace the financial advisor. Mm-hmm. What do you think cannot be replaced? You know, what is the function that you think cannot be replaced?
I'll give you a personal example. For me, my advisors, I started with them when I had not a whole lot to invest, and they took a chance on me, and I've grown to actually be a client that is deserving of their services. But what they did for me is they made me and my family save 25% of our income every year. And that's a hard thing to do, and gross income. So when you're saving 25% and you're taxed, you know, if you think about everything after taxes, that's saving a lot of money, but we are in great shape because of that. And believe me, some years I didn't want to write a check for 25%, you know, but I'm so happy I did, because that makes a huge difference. So the piece that can't be replaced is that coaching piece, that reminder that to keep, it's like keeping you exercising. It's like, no, you are going to save 25% this year. You aren't going to do that vacation. You're going to put it in savings. And so that's what can't be replaced, because we as humans, if given the opportunity, would spend everything we earn.
Yeah. So it's a coaching. I completely agree. And it's a human side that it's the needs, the coaching. I worked a lot some time ago with a financial advisory firm, and we reposition them to help them actually say, you're not a financial coach, you're more closer to a life coach.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's not that you're going to have all the answers, but you're going to help them direct them in the right answers and, you know, be there for them, et cetera. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And my group actually focuses on, you know, twice a year meetings, making sure your life insurance is up to date, making sure your beneficiaries are up to date, like things that often are just a pain to deal with, but having somebody remind you a couple times a year to check on all that, make sure you're putting money in your HSA, you know, all of those cosmetic things are super important. But another thing I'd mention is my current company is also helping consumers who have gotten into really bad auto loans. And that requires, in many cases, a human to really work through people's financial situation. Because sometimes people get into a really bad loan on a car because they're in a desperate situation. And so they need counseling and help to figure out, how do I get this loan in a better situation, but how do I get other things in my financial life on track? And so it does go back to that coaching piece where, first of all, if you can break down the barrier of people being embarrassed about what the, you know, when they get themselves into a situation, once you establish that trust and help them figure out cash flow, it's life-changing, because some people are just stressed out every day about finances, about something that somebody out there could actually help them with, but they don't know who or how to get in touch. And so that's where I think, you know, the work that's done by people who do that financial coaching is just very important to help people's, you know, stress levels and, you know, have their life be a little bit more positive, you know?
So for you, actually, in your firm, the key is going to be to integrate the technology with the human component, right?
Yes, that's what we have to figure out how to do, because today most of our interactions are voice to voice through phone channel, but we're trying to figure out how to, you know, continue to offer more channels, because we know being on the phone is not something people can do.
Right.
Yeah.
Or they don't want to, right?
Exactly. Younger generation doesn't want to.
So let's close with this one. Tell me something that you think that's true, but most people wouldn't agree with you.
There's something I'm very passionate and adamant about, and I probably take it to the extreme. I learned, it really solidified my learning in raising my daughter. My strong belief is that positive reinforcement is the only way to influence anyone. And a lot of people disagree with me, particularly folks who have, let's say, a military background or are big into, you know, sports where there's a lot of screaming at people to get them to do better or whatnot. I have learned that if somebody is not doing a good job, if I go to them and tell them all the things they're doing wrong, they're going to continue spiraling and not do a good job. Same thing with the kid. If they're off track, if you point how they're off track, they get attention for being off track and it continues them down that journey. Whereas if you can really focus on something that they're doing that's great and distract them into what their greatness is, you will see them continue to improve, whether it's a child, an employee, a peer. Because there is, you know, a lot of people will tell you people become what you tell them they will become. So if you tell somebody they're an idiot and they're never going to become anything, that is exactly what's going to happen. But if you tell them they are the smartest person in the room and they're going to help others, you'd be surprised. That's actually what's going to come across. And so every day when I'm working with people, even if I have feedback, I always start with what somebody is doing brilliantly around. And if other things need to be improved, I always put that in a more positive light, because I feel the way to keep engaging and motivating, I mean, all of us have things that we aren't good at. We don't need people to remind us of all the things we aren't good at. If people can really focus on what we are great at and let us do that in our work and our fun in life, I think the world is a better place. So I'm just huge into positive reinforcement. And I've had a lot of people completely disagree with me. I've had leaders that were the complete opposite, that thought, you know, berating somebody in a meeting was the way to get higher performance, when in reality, you just disengage people and they leave you. Yeah. So, you know, I've had tough times and tough conversations, but at the end of the day, I am friends with most of the people that I've worked with through all my years. And the reason is because I, you know, develop friendships and care about people. And when you care about people, you know their strengths and weaknesses, and always pointing to somebody's strength makes people want to be around you and makes people to work harder for you and with you. And that's, you know, so that's kind of my way of managing, but not everybody's, and particularly the older generation, does things quite differently.
No, that's not the case. But where did you learn it?
It was through my daughter. At a very young age, I realized if I would give her compliments, she would double down, triple down. If I would fuss at her, she was down for hours. And I came to know from everything from potty training to anything else you're trying to convince a child to do, if you can focus them on something that they're really good at, it just changes. You know, you see kids on planes having a meltdown. That's a parent who hasn't figured out how to distract them into something they're really good at and into positivity. I often want to go grab some of these kids on the plane and help out. Because, you know, the more you fuss at a kid, it's not going to change their trajectory. In fact, they're going to ramp it up. So.
It's just that being a parent, I think that's what makes you grow and change the most, because it's the hardest change, actually, to change from what your parents were to what you want to be. And that's the hardest one to make, right?
It is. Yes. As everyone says it, parenting is the hardest and the best thing you ever do, but it changes you. It actually softened me a whole lot, which was a good thing and probably needed to happen.
Good. Great. Yeah, that happened to me too, actually. I became more emotional, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Cry on a dime. It's like, okay.
I have this joke with my sister. It's like whenever I see a play by the kids or something, and I start crying. I'm like, I'm crying like mom.
Exactly. And they'll understand when they're older, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was such a pleasure, Renee. Thank you so much. I had so much fun.
Well, no, thank you. And yes, and I look forward to, I need to start tuning into your broadcast. So thank you for including me.
Thank you.